Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 421 of the podcast. And it is Friday, 8th of March, 2019, as I record this. So today I am super excited to bring you this interview with Professor Marcus de Sautoy on AI and creativity. And he has a book out just yesterday as I record this. And you know that I'm fascinated by futurist stuff. And if you're interested in how AI might impact our life as authors, not that far in the future, stick around for the interview. Now, we did record it before the announcement of the OpenAI text tool, which I discussed a few weeks back in episode 418 in the introduction, before Will from Findaway's interview. So if you want that, and I talk at length about that, so I won't repeat it here, but go back and listen to episode 418 in the introduction in terms of OpenAI. But otherwise, that interview with Marcus is coming up. In publishing and book marketing news, very exciting, BookBub have announced Chirp, which is a new way to promote audiobooks, although there are a few restrictions, let's say, on what's going on here. First of all, it is US only, and of course, as ever, I'm a global author, as are many of you. So I have asked them about this, and they are looking at how they will roll this out into other markets. Of course, if you use BookBub already for ebooks, you'll know they have international deals included. So hopefully this will be rolled out in the future, because certainly I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I know many of you do too, and we would love something like this. So it is also fascinating because of the interview I did with Will from Findaway, because BookBub are partnering with Findaway for this. And the reason is, and many people have said, oh, but you can't use ACX with this, you can't use Audible books. That's because ACX does not allow you to control the price. So how can you run a deal on something where you can't change the price? So why I like this, I like this because it's about time we had some promotional tools for audio, but also I like this because this is going to foster wide distribution for audio. And the other thing I would say is that they have a wait list for authors. So if you want to do discounted audiobooks, even if you have not gone wide yet with audio, then please go and sign up on the wait list, because they are going to look at the waitlist, and that will probably direct how they roll this out, you know, if there are more authors in a particular genre or a particular area or whatever. So go and sign up about that. I'll put the links in the show notes as ever, or just search Chirp audiobooks and I'm sure you'll find that. But essentially, I think this is really fantastic, and I hope that there will be more options for promotion of audio over time. In my personal update this week, I am now at 30,000 words with Map of Plagues. So that is progressing. And also my short story, The Dark Queen, which I narrated, is available on all the usual audiobook stores. So that is out now as well. So very pleased. I now have 1,000 Fiendish Angels and The Dark Queen, my narrated audio. And thanks to everyone who has actually downloaded and bought 1,000 Fiendish Angels. And of course, these are short stories, so they're much cheaper. So if you want to have me read you a story in my very serious voice, then check that out. I'm also in the final stages of my new site and my new podcast to be unveiled next week. And of course, if you are a patron or you're in my content marketing course, you will get advance notice, and I will be telling you about that early. So that's very, because I've been talking about that sort of more in detail behind the scenes. So I will also be at London Book Fair this week, and I have been every year to LBF since 2012. And I always learn some interesting things, and I get to catch up with author friends and publishing friends from all over the world. And there are lots of sessions on audiobooks this year, which gives a real sense of its growing importance in the publishing industry. So I will give a roundup on that next week, so you'll learn everything I learned along the way. In terms of useful stuff, I have a webinar coming up. So would you like to get some more book reviews in an entirely ethical manner that adheres to the Amazon Terms of Service? Yes, we are doing a book review webinar. Come and join me and Mark Dawson for a webinar on 21st of March on how to get your first or your next 10 book reviews. Now, I've done this webinar with Mark before, super popular, and I wrote notes on some ideas for getting more reviews. So it's definitely useful. It is aimed at authors who are just starting out, or if you want to revisit the basics, or let's face it, if you just need some help getting some reviews. And this will be on Thursday, the 21st of March at 4 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK, as it's in that weird time slot before the UK clocks change. So I will be there in the chat as Mark does his presentation. We will also both do a live Q&A as part of that session. And those of you who know my webinars know that we always have a bit of a banter, and it's entertaining as well as useful. And you will go home with, well, you'll be at home or at work, but you will have info-packed useful stuff as well. If you register, you can get the replay. If you can't join us live, go to thecreativepen.com/21March. So 21 M-A-R-C-H, links in the show notes as ever. So thank you for all your emails and tweets this week. RJ Amos says, listening to the latest podcast while driving to a lunch date, was glad to get there a few minutes early and with my laptop so I could tweak the novel to make my villain more attached to his family, which is great after the Sasha Black interview last week. Tara Jade Brown says, really enjoyed this episode. P.S. I've been ignoring Instagram until I heard Sasha Black making the best pitch ever. Okay, I'm in. And yes, Tara, I also got into Instagram and Sasha helped me along the way. And I am at JF Pen Author if you want to follow me on Instagram, where I share lots of pictures of my travels. Lisa M. Lilly pulled out tarot decks for inspiration thanks to the recent interview with Caroline Donahue. Had forgotten what a great way it is to get unstuck. And oh yeah, a lovely little tweet from LJ McMenemy. That's a great name. I hope I said that right, LJ. Anyway, LJ says, as my 5-year period of writing despair took over and I stopped my fiction adventures, I lost touch with my digital mentors. I've now rediscovered The Creative Pen through her podcast. What a treat. I'm voraciously catching up on the 400-odd episode back catalogue. So welcome back, LJ. And I guess I loved this because 5 years away, you return and I'm still here. And I'm quite proud of myself really for being still here. And that's also my lesson, I think, this week is still be here. It can be so discouraging when things go up and down and we hear different news and we feel like, oh, you know, the world is difficult and, you know, things are going on that make you feel like giving up. And clearly LJ here had some difficulties and moved away from writing. And there's no judgment with that whatsoever. We all need a break sometimes. But what I have learned in my 10 years, and also from learning from people who have been in the writing industry for the long term, people like Christine Catherine Rush, Dean Wesley Smith, my friend Orna Ross, other people who have been around 10, 20, 30, 40 years in this industry. And when I go to events like Thriller Fest and other events when authors are just persistent, if you just keep turning up to the page and working on your creativity, you will write something. If you just keep turning up and creating stuff in the world, you will create a career, which is what I have done. And I hope that encourages you a bit, because when I saw this tweet, my heart went out to LJ. And I'm certainly intending to continue to be here. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Ingram Spark, and I'll play a word from the lovely Robin Cutler in a minute. And if you get a chance to see Robin at events, or she speaks at a lot of events, she's fantastic. She'll be at London Book Fair this week, so I'm looking forward to seeing her. Also, just to reiterate how much I personally love Ingram Spark, I'm going to just answer a little question. Because I saw a tweet this week from Dr. Ortigara Crago saying, "Thank you, Joanna. I didn't realise I could publish print on demand with Ingram Spark and Amazon with the same book and the same ISBN." So I just wanted, before I play the bit from Robin, I just wanted to outline my process, because this is super important, and clearly it's confusing some people. So essentially, yes, you can use the same ISBN. You have to own your ISBN to publish on Ingram Spark. But again, it's an investment in your author business. And if you want wide distribution, then it's really worthwhile. So basically, I publish my paperback on KDP Print, but do not check the extended distribution button. Then I publish on Ingram Spark for the extended distribution, because they reach many thousands of bookstores, libraries, universities, and many more outlets worldwide. They also enable hardbacks, which I'm doing for my whole backlist, and I love them. You can also set up discounting, which means bookstores can order copies and still make a living, and we all want to support bookstores, and we can get cheaper bulk author copies, which is great if you're doing events or want to sell signed copies. So yes, you can use the same ISBN, and you just upload the book files. They are slightly different, so you might need to work with your designer, but essentially you upload them to KDP Print and also Ingram Spark for that wide distribution, if you choose to go this route, obviously. And I've now been with Ingram over two years, and my print sales, I'm looking forward to the end of my tax year. And I'll probably do that report in around June. I'll report on my whole year. And last year, certainly my print sales had doubled since I'd been with Ingram Spark. So very interesting to see what will happen this year. So it's your content. Do more with it with Ingram Spark. And I'll play a word from Robin in a minute. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, transcription and editing of the podcast. But my time in creating the show is sponsored by my patrons. And of course, now we have over 420 episodes. I've spent a hell of a lot of time on this show. I'm so glad you're all still finding it useful. So thanks to everyone who's supporting the show on Patreon. And thanks to new patrons, Shauna Braun, Dean Buswell and Julie Nolan. I really appreciate your support on Patreon. Like the tweets and emails, it demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can support the show with only a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month if you're feeling generous, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, including the backlist. So tons of audio fun. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from Ingram Spark, and then let's get on with the interview.
Hi, everyone. I'm Robin Cutler, director of Ingram Spark, an award-winning independent publishing platform that offers authors, including Joanna Penn, a way to publish and distribute print and ebooks to over 39,000 online and physical booksellers and libraries worldwide. The new year always brings about resolutions, and if you're listening to the Creative Pen podcast, one of yours may be to write and publish your book this year. If so, we hope you'll consider making Ingram Spark part of your publishing journey. With dozens of trim sizes, color, hardcovers, paperbacks, ebooks, global distribution, Along with free publisher education to help you succeed, Ingram Spark believes it's your content. We just help you do more with it. Do more with your book this year when you get started at www.ingramspark.com.
Today, I'm here with Marcus DeSotoy. Hi, Marcus.
Hello.
Thanks for coming on the show. Just a little introduction. Marcus is the Simonyi Professor for the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. Quite a mouthful. He's also a prize-winning professor of mathematics, a fellow of New College, and a fellow of the Royal Society. He's the author of several prize-winning books, and his latest is The Creativity Code, How AI is Learning to Write, Paint, and Think, which is a super exciting topic. So, Marcus, we got to start with, why is a maths professor writing a book about creativity? I know some people might find that difficult.
Yes, I think usually the words maths and creativity don't go together if you're not a mathematician. But if you're a mathematician, actually, it's a very important part of our work. And I think it goes to the heart of the fact that we're making a lot of choices, actually, when we're creating our mathematics. We don't want to just create mathematics that's true, because quite often that's boring. We try to choose mathematics which takes our the people who attend our seminars, the people who read our papers in our journals, on a kind of emotional journey. We want to transform them, to change them, to make them go, whoa, I didn't realize those two things were connected. And so in charting out that kind of journey, it requires a lot of choice, aesthetics, and creativity, because you're having to go to places which are new. So, you know, what is creativity? I defined it in this new book as something which is new, but that's not just good enough, because, that could be very boring. So it's got to be surprising, and it's got to have some sort of value. It's got to kind of be worthwhile in some way. And I think that's what a mathematician is trying to do, create new kind of truths about numbers, geometries. But it's got to be surprising. It's got to kind of move you in some way. And if it's got value as well, then that really, wins the biscuits. So creativity is something which is very important to me as a mathematician, perhaps more than a scientist. I mean, scientists have to be quite creative, but they're kind of bound very often by the physical universe that we live in. As a mathematician, I've got much more freedom, actually, to be imaginative in my world, create new worlds that perhaps aren't physical. And I think that's much closer to being an artist than a scientist.
Yeah, and I love this emotional journey of mathematics, and your book does that really well. I'm not someone who reads mathematics books much, but this kind of crosses the boundaries, which is fantastic. So let's come to AI, because I really discovered AI in a big way when AlphaGo beat the Go world champion. And I read in your book that that moment was pivotal for you as well. So let's just revisit that. Why was that such a big deal in 2016?
It was a big deal, especially for me as a mathematician, because I've always used the game of Go as a good analogy for doing mathematics. I think a lot of people thought chess was quite a good analogy, and you know, a computer beat the world champion at chess in the mid-90s. But I think why Go is closer to being a mathematician is that you're not quite sure why you make certain moves. It requires a little bit of intuition, pattern recognition, a bit of creativity. And so for me, I'd always use that game as a kind of protective shield against the idea that AI could do mathematics. So I watched this game with a lot of kind of angst and existential angst. But for me, the most significant thing was not just that this computer managed to beat a world champion at this very complex game. There was a moment in game two where the computer made a move. It's move 37. And I talk about it in the book because I think this is a kind of a pivotal moment. When all the commentators went, whoa, it's made a mistake, because it was doing something that you're taught as a Go player never to do, which is to play on a kind of particular line on this 19 by 19 grid. But as the game evolved, we realized that it wasn't a mistake. It was a deeply incisive move. It was incredibly creative because it was new, surprised us, and it had value because it ultimately won game two for the AI. So I think for me, that was one of the most exciting things. It it enabled us to see how to play the game in a completely new way. So it was being creative. But not only that, the way this thing had been programmed was significantly different. And I think this is why there's a real kind of phase change in AI. I mean, it's like water going to steam boiling, because this computer had not been sort of, the program hadn't been written by a sort of human and the human knew what it was doing. The human had written the program so the program could learn, adapt, and change. And so ultimately, by the end of all the training it did, we actually didn't know how it was making its decisions, why it was making its decisions. And this new AI, which we call machine learning, because it learns how to program itself, it's a bit like a child who's born, and in the past, the child had nowhere to kind of learn on. But suddenly we've got this new AI, a child, which can learn by interacting with its environment, change and become something more than its parents, as it were.
Mm. And then what happened after that AlphaGo beat the human?
You're obviously thinking about something. So
yeah, the next iteration of AlphaGo, I can't remember what it's called, right?
Yes, it's called AlphaZero. Oh, yes. This is because in some ways AlphaGo had been given the rules of the game and had been given human games to play on. So it learned from what we'd done as humans. And so you feel, okay, well, it's extending our intelligence and creativity. But then DeepMind, who developed AlphaGo, developed something called AlphaZero, where they just gave the computer the 19 by 19 grid, the pixels, and a score. And it had to learn how to play the game, the rules of the game. And so this was a kind of tabula rasa learning. It didn't know anything. And by the end of its evolution, it was actually better than the AlphaGo that had beat Lee Sedol. So this, I think, is genuinely exciting because it didn't have to learn from things we'd already learned. It started from zero. I mean, that's almost true creativity, you know, something from nothing. So it's very interesting it was able to do that. I'm quite surprised that without any sort of guidance that it reached such a phenomenal level. And actually, it even learned to play chess in an afternoon and beats all the computers that programmed to chess and also a kind of Chinese version of chess. So this is exciting and perhaps a little bit scary for some people.
And I think, you know, some people will now be listening going, oh yeah, but it's still like a game. It's still Go. It's still chess. But give us some examples of how AI is also creating in the, you know, the music and the writing and all these different things that is already happening.
Yes, I mean, I agree with you. It looks a nice closed sort of environment, the game of Go, and it is. And I think that's why it was a good place to start. But now this AI, if it can learn, well, why not expose it to other things, not just games of Go, but the art that we love, the novels we like to write, the poetry, the music. And music is an interesting one because it's also quite a sort of self-contained environment. If you think about it, it's got notes on page, certain frequencies. That's why there's a lot of connection between maths and music. So AI learning on what we've composed in the past and extending it has been very successful. So somehow AI always starts with Bach as the composer because so they try and sort of make more Bach, partly because Bach is very algorithmic in the way that he writes his music. And I think that's one thing I wanted to illustrate in the book, that artistic creativity isn't as kind of mysterious as we think it is, that actually there's a lot of kind of structure, pattern, almost algorithm in the way that we do our creation of pieces of art. And so the book is partly showing why actually we're responding to things in the kind of artistic realm because they've got that kind of hidden structure that we're trying to unpick. So if we can understand that, then maybe the AI can go and sort of extend that into other realms. So we've now got examples, for example, a jazz improviser trained on another jazz musician's riffs. The AI learnt those riffs, but then extended the kind of sound world of this jazz musician. And what's interesting there is the jazz musician said, look, I recognize what this AI is producing. It's my world, but it's doing things I never thought were possible. So I think this is an example of the exciting role that AI can play in a creative's life, because it's as if that jazz musician was stuck in a corner of the room with just a small light on, didn't realize that they were sitting in a huge, great big hall, and the AI has turned the lights on and showed, well, look, look at all these other places that you can go to with your sound world. So music has been an exciting progress. The art world, well, there are some curious things like a new Rembrandt was painted because the AI learnt what Rembrandt had done on the in the past, the sort of his use of light, the sort of faces that he likes to paint. And by taking that information, was able to produce something which I think is pretty convincing as a Rembrandt-esque painting.
It was sold at Sotheby's, right, as well?
Oh, that's another painting. Sotheby's, or I think it was Christie's, actually. It was the first AI piece of art. And I think this is again, interesting because, you know, Rembrandt, we've already got fantastic Rembrandts. We don't need anything new there. So I think what we want is AI to take us somewhere new and exciting, not to reproduce the old. And this piece of AI that was sold at Christie's, I think it was, it was created actually by making art into a bit of a game, because it was using something called a generative adversarial network, or a GAN. And this is taking two algorithms which kind of compete against each other. So one algorithm is creating art, which it tries to make new and not derivative, but not too new that you just don't recognize it as a chaotic mess. The other algorithm then says, no, I spot that. That's very Picasso-esque, or no, you've now gone into a realm that, you know, that's not art. And the two competed against each other and created something which was kind of a new sort of art. And that's what went on sale at Christie's.
And that's the bit I think is just like writers. I don't know about maths, but I think there's this generative, as you say, which is the creative mind, which is, you know, I'm back in first draft. That's the first draft thing. And then the adversarial, which we would call critical voice, or the editor, is the bit that goes through and kind of says, oh, no, that's not so great, or that needs fixing, or whatever. So that, to me, almost sounds human-like.
I agree with you. And I think I have quite a few quotes from people in the book, the painters especially, and a poet, Paul Valéry, who talks about the fact that you need two people in your mind, one being super creative and throwing out ideas, and the other one being critical and making choices about, no, that's not good, that is good. And certainly I do that in mathematics, and very often I will do that in partnership with somebody else. So we have a lot of collaborations, and I have partners across the world that I create my mathematics with. And sometimes I'll be the kind of good guy suggesting loads of mad ideas. And then my colleague in Germany, he's the one who shoots it down. Or I have a colleague in Israel. He's the generative one, and I'm the adversarial one in that context. So I think we do use this paradigm quite a lot. So I think it's interesting that AI has latched onto it as a powerful way to make things new things.
So what about writing then? Because I hear my audience saying, yes, but nobody's written, an AI hasn't written anything. So tell us about the poetry, automated insights, you know, what's going on with writing?
Well, your writers will be encouraged to learn that I think of all the arts that I looked at in this book, that I think writing is still the furthest away from AI being able to achieve anything like humans can. I think their writing could music and also visual art. But there have been some examples. People might remember a story about a new Harry Potter. So again, this is machine learning, because what the AI took was the, you know, the seven volumes that J.K. Rowling has written, saw the sort of sentences she likes, the sort of connections she likes making, and then produced kind of the beginning of an eighth volume. But actually, here's a warning about AI, because I looked under the bonnet of this piece of AI and actually ran it on some of my own books to see whether I could, you know, maybe I can put myself out at a job or get the AI to write my book for me. And what I understood was, there's still a lot of human creativity going on in an exercise like that. So the the algorithm offered me at each point 18 different choices of words which could follow the word you've just had. And I had to choose which of those that I would write. So, and this is a warning, because I think a lot of the news stories love to say AI has painted a new picture, AI has written the Harry Potter. And it doesn't make a good news story if you say human writes with the aid of a computer. And so the human gets kind of put to the side, and it's sort of celebrated as a piece of AI. But I think, actually, I heard Demis Hassabis. He said a nice thing, who was the creator of DeepMind and AlphaGo. And he said it's like in the turn of the century when everybody was just putting .com at the end of their companies to hype their value. And at the moment, we've just got everyone putting AI, you know, made with AI, machine learning. So be warned that not everything is always AI. But that's not to say that there are roles that AI can play in creative writing. Poetry has been a very interesting place, because it's quite a constrained sort of environment. Sometimes you're almost putting rules on yourself to push you into kind of new ways of thinking. I think that's often why I quite enjoy sort of writing poetry if I do, because it's sort of, I have to think of something that matches what I've just done if I'm trying to keep a particular rhythm going. So there have been some interesting examples, and I suppose they're more successful because poetry has always had a kind of gnomic quality. You're never quite sure what on earth this means. And so I think AI can get away with a lot in this environment, because it can write something which, you know, you can think, well, that sounds kind of weird. And it could easily be sort of human going off on some weird kind of path. So I reference a little exercise that you can do, which is trying to spot whether something's written by a bot or not. And it's somebody's put forward some different poems composed by humans, which actually sound quite machine-like, and vice versa. I suppose there's I think the most interesting have been some exercises. Some of your writers might have been involved in the November writing month.
Yes, NaNoWriMo, yeah.
NaNoWriMo, exactly. My mum has done a couple of NaNoWriMos. But somebody came up with a cunning idea. So this is to write a novel in the month, you know, really disciplined, pump out the words. But this was a kind of variant on that idea, which is, no, just write a piece of AI, write a bit of code that will make the novel for you. So you spend the month not writing, but coming up with code that will do the writing for you. So there have been some very interesting examples of that. And most of them, again, are quite derivative. They're taking things like Moby Dick and running it through a Twitter filter. But I thought one of the most interesting was one by somebody called Thrice Dotted. That's her pseudonym. And she wrote something called The Seeker. And this is the AI takes WikiHow, which if anyone's gone on WikiHow, it's, you know, how to ask a girlfriend out on a date, or how to bake bread, or how to. And the code has kind of thought, well, this is, I want to learn what it's like to be human. So I'm going to go through these pages of how to on WikiHow and learn what it is to be human. And the algorithm kind of generates responses to the WikiHow pages. Now, for me, this is most interesting because I think this is where creativity and AI is going to be richest, which is when AI becomes a kind of entity in its own right, and it wants to try and communicate with us, and we want to try and understand its world. I think, you know, why do we write novels? We write novels because we want to get inside the mind of the other, or to share our minds with others. I think it's trying to solve the hard problem of consciousness, that we can't know what it feels like to be you, or what it feels like to be me. And our novels are almost like an fMRI scanner, reading into the brain of the other. So I think this will become most interesting when AI becomes conscious. And then we will need to hear their stories in order to understand what it's like to be that machine.
People are going, when AI becomes conscious, which, you know, I wasn't going to get here so fast, but you, there are lots of people who worry about AI becoming conscious. Obviously, Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, famous names, dystopian sci-fi writers. And you mention that story might be the answer to the evil AI. So maybe just talk about that a minute.
Yes, because I think that I think it has been a little bit too dystopian, and I'm hoping this book is actually a more positive take on AI and how AI can be a useful tool, but perhaps go further. And if it does become conscious, then we're going to need it on our side. You know, we want to work together. There was an exercise which took the idea of how to tell a story. Many of your writers might have watched Bandersnatch just recently, the Black Mirror on Netflix, where you get to make choices along the way about what the characters do. And of course, this is a very old idea. Books I used to love as a kid, where, you know, turn to page 37 if you go through the left door or that. This research team did was to train AI on the way that humans tell stories. So we tell stories which aren't too dystopian most of the time, I think, or at least we tell stories about what it means to be human. And then the AI, having trained on this, was let loose on a kind of tree of possibilities of a story to tell. And what was encouraging was, because it had learnt how humans tell stories, it chose a pathway that was kind of more human-like, horrific choices, which weren't kind of emotionally involved. It took a pathway that humans responded to. Mm. And so I think that if we can train the AI that's emerging, in a sense, to be empathetic by reading our stories, by understanding our art, and therefore being sympathetic to producing something similar, then we might have an empathetic AI will not be one that will hopefully wipe us out. And I actually put the quote by Ian McEwan, whose response to 9/11 was, if those hijackers had been able to put themselves in the minds of the passengers on those planes, would they have been able to carry out the act that they did? And I think this is partly why we have art, is to be able to share our different ways of looking at the world and to try and to mix minds and not separate minds.
Mm, I love that. I love that story might be the answer to the whole AI thing. I just love it. But I want to ask you just some technical questions that I think authors are really concerned with. So the first one is the copyright question. So we had a new quote, the macaque selfie, the monkey selfie, which I'm sure everyone can remember. And it was an item created by a non-human cannot be copyrighted. So what does that mean if we're using AI as a tool? Like if I feed the AI my 17 novels and it spits out something I can use, what happens with copyright then?
Yes, I think this is still a very grey area. And it's partly why I spent a couple of years on a committee at the Royal Society in London, sort of looking at the impact that machine learning is going to have on AI on the future. And I think these legal issues are ones we just are not quite sure about yet. I mean, I think fundamental things like driverless cars, if it causes an accident, who is to blame? Is it the person who programmed the car? Is it the driver who owns the car? So I think similar issues come up with copyright. If somebody writes a piece of code, but they take material that the code is learning on, which belongs to somebody else, and so the result is in a product of, say, your novels, but the bit of code written by somebody else. So who owns the copyright there? And I think this is really interesting, because I actually start the book with something called the Ada Lovelace Challenge, because Ada Lovelace said, hey, look, she was one of the first programmers, was interested in the idea that this analytical machine that Babbage had made might be able to do more than just mathematical calculations. And she suggested music could be one of the things. Mm. But she cautioned and said, look, this will never be able to do more than the programmer who wrote it. And so that's the challenge of the book. Well, is that really true anymore, because these things seem to be really creative? Mm. So if it's going beyond the person who's coded the thing, it seems to be creating things which are not what the coder expected. So should that be therefore belonging? Is that the still the coder's kind of property? Because or should it start to be something else? If you think about the way movies are made, a movie actually is just the, generally the ownership of a movie, because there are so many people involved in that, it generally has to be owned by a company. So it's not actually a person. It belongs to a sort of a legal identity, just which kind of deals with the fact that there are many creative processes going in. And you just couldn't pull this thing apart if everyone said, but that line was my line or that. So I wonder whether we're going to get to a similar sort of situation where we will have to recognize maybe some legal status for AI, which will incorporate the creativity of the coder, the creativity of the things that are being learnt on. But I think we're going into unexplored territory here.
And then I also wanted to ask about translation, because this is something I'm really super excited about, because just last year, a translation AI translated a non-fiction, and that's important, a non-fiction book, 100,000 words in 30 seconds into Mandarin, from English to Mandarin. And then an editor took a week to clean that up. And it would have taken 6 months, apparently, to have translated with a human. So I wonder about that, because in that case, surely the AI did the first draft, which is normally what an author does. And therefore, that just really confused me. And I'm very interested in what's going to happen with translation with AI. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, well, language translation has been very successful. And it is a great thing for machine learning to work on, because in the past, I suppose a translation would be, it'd be sort of top-down coding where you would say, okay, well, you've got a dictionary, you translate things. But very often, subtlety of sentences means that just a simple translation of each word using a dictionary doesn't capture it. Mm. And the language tools now are being very effective at really capturing the meaning of a sentence because they learn on the way that we use language. But they still aren't perfect. And I think that's where, you said a human had to come in and tidy it up. And I think one of the things I kept on hearing when I did my research for this book was the words good enough, that the AI can produce music which is good enough for, a game or a corporate video, but isn't going to be performed in the concert hall. And again, when it came to translation, the translations were good enough to communicate the message that somebody was trying to write in one language. But if you really wanted the full subtleties, then you needed a human to come in. Mm. And there's an interesting guy that I've always been very interested in called Douglas Hofstadter, who wrote the book Gödel-Escher Bach. Mm. Yeah. He's actually been looking at AI for 50 years or so. But he's very down on AI as far as translation goes. And he produced some very interesting examples which just throw a computer because they just don't understand kind of context. Things between languages, for example, in English, we don't have words don't have a masculine or feminine form, but in French they do. And that can cause real problems when you start translating. Because if you say something like his car and her car, his house and her house, his book and her book, that translates very difficultly into French because, sa voiture et sa voiture. Right. They're both. Well, where's the his and the her there? So I think and you've picked up on one thing, which I think is quite exciting, that although computers are very good, humans are also very good. And actually, it's going to be the combination of the two, which is best. So already, if you go back to the game of Go, which we already talked about, if you combine a human with the AI, then together they can beat certainly a human, but they can also beat the AI on its own. And we've seen this also in medical research as well. AI, one of the big things it's being used for is in healthcare. It's able to scan pictures and pick up tumors, for example, which are being missed by human radiographers. But again, the combination of a human and the AI seems to be better than both of them. So I'm hoping that's the future, that we're going to use this as a very powerful tool to speed up translation. But it won't ever be as good as a human in picking up kind of subtleties of use of language that the AI is just missing.
Fantastic. Well, I want to pick up then, I mean, a bit earlier you said it's a bit like when everyone stuck .com on the end of everything. And of course, then you're probably talking 1998 to 2000, you know, the kind of the .com boom. But of course, we are, you know, now, nearly 20 years later, and you and I are talking over the internet. I run a business on the internet. You're collaborating over the internet, and we all are in a .com world.
Yes, yes.
So how, what do you see, you know, are we talking really fast change? Are we talking 20 years? What did you conclude? Are you out of a job? Am I out of a job? And how fast?
Well, I think there's a speed is very important here, because people comparing this revolution to something like the Industrial Revolution, which had a massive impact on work and people's lives and caused a lot of poverty. But the Industrial Revolution, I think, happened over a generation. You know, it was your son or daughter that didn't get the job that you had. I think the speed of this revolution is way faster. And I think that what we're doing now, 10 years time, we will have to be doing something completely different. So I think that we have to be ready for change. We have to know how to learn new things, and which I think is exciting. I enjoy the challenge of not getting stuck in my ways and having to do something new. But I think that's where AI is going to help us. I think that too often we get stuck in our ways, and actually we end up behaving more like machines than the machines, because we just keep on churning out the same sort of things. We get stuck in certain formulas for the way we write or the way we think. And AI is being able to analyze what we're doing and suggest to us new pathways. Maybe you could try this. Maybe you could try that. And, you know, we might not like all the suggestions, but some of them may resonate and take us off into a new direction. So I think that's the really exciting positive side of this AI, that it's going to open up huge possibilities in our creative process that we are kind of sitting there ready to be ignited, but we didn't know were there.
Yeah, well, I'm excited too. And that's why I wanted to talk to you. I was like, yay, someone else who's excited about our future. So thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you and your book and everything you do online?
Well, all my books in the UK are published by Fourth Estate, who are a wonderful publisher. I've loved them and stuck with them all the way. And I have a website. So I'm the Simone Professor for the Public Understanding of Science, as you said, quite a mouthful. So I have a website where I put a lot of the activities that I do, radio work that I archive, television work, and also my books. So that's www.simoney, which is spelled S-I-M-O-N-Y-I, .ox.ac.uk. I'm also on Twitter, which is where I kind of use as a microblog. So that's at Marcus DeSotoy.
Thanks so much for your time, Marcus. That was great.
Yeah, real pleasure.
So I hope you enjoyed this interview with Marcus today, and that it has made you feel more positive about the future of creativity alongside AI. He and I are clearly glass half full people. And I'm always enjoy talking to people who are positive about our future. And you know, I will continue to update you on AI developments in the Futurist segment whenever anything interesting pops up. So next week is my 10th anniversary show. Yes, the first episode of the Creative Pen podcast was 15th of March, 2009. Years go past so quickly. And I'll be talking about some lessons learned from the last 10 years, as well as announcing my next 10-year plan. Or at least what I'm doing with the new site and the new podcast. And don't worry, this show is not going anywhere. It is... I'm just doing the other one differently so that it's not so intense. But I'll be talking about all those things. So happy writing, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint.
If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.